Korea is making a push to strengthen its standing on the world stage. People on the ground have more basic needs.
You name it. Everything. Electricity, water supply, fuels, public services.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, building a new economy in Syria. Also, what's next for thousands of refugees who were headed to the U.S. before a resettlement program was paused?
In Turkey, outrage after a deadly fire.
You don't cut corners on safety.
And Oscar nominations are in. One French movie got 13 nods.
That is the same number of nominations as Oppenheimer had last year. The difference being, for me, that Oppenheimer is an enduring, impressive accomplishment.
Ouch! That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for being here today. Syria has been finding its footing since militants brought down the Assad regime in December. The new government has been on a high-speed campaign to strengthen its diplomatic standing abroad.
But for Syrians themselves, one of the most urgent needs is economic reform. That's going to be hard. The country's emerging from war and remains under tough sanctions from the U.S. and the EU. Karim Shah is a Syrian economist who's been talking with the new government. He joined us from Damascus and explained how much Syria has to overcome.
Practically, right before the downfall of the Assad regime, Syria was a typical textbook case of crony capitalism, where you have the security apparatus managing the economy indirectly through a network of cronies who themselves do the business and benefit themselves and the security apparatus, headed by Bashar al-Assad and his brother Maher al-Assad. This formulation has actually brought the economy down to its knees because as Syria has been under sanctions for a long time and the sanctions have been tightening over time, the size of the economic pie has been shrinking. And the response of the regime has been to claim and demand a higher share of that shrinking pie. The way they've been doing it is by using their cronies, and most recently they also started actually using their business fronts. So they just appoint people who own companies nominally, but ultimately the companies are actually owned by Bashar al-Assad directly through his presidential palace. I think practically this is one of the main reasons why the regime has collapsed entirely. That is because the share of people who are in that ruling elite has been becoming smaller and smaller and smaller, to the point that Bashar al-Assad broke the number one rule in politics, which is no one rules alone.
So what did that mean for the daily lives of ordinary people?
The vast majority of people have been reeling under excruciating economic mismanagement, the conflict, mind-numbing corruption, and sanctions. The share of people living in poverty, if you look at multidimensional poverty, is actually above 90%, according to the United Nations. You see people actually now, I'm in Damascus, the share of people who are begging on the street is, I mean, I've never seen it like this before. It's heartbreaking.
So, I mean, if you had to define what the new government's vision for Syria's post-Assad economy is, what would you say?
I think what we're seeing from the caretaker government is a strong tendency for neoliberal economic policies. That is, very free economic atmosphere and regulations for competition, allowing everyone to enter the economic scene, but also without showing enough interest in social welfare and so on and so forth. I think the model that we're seeing, or the one that is being proposed at the moment, is dangerous to me because of not only not taking into account social welfare, at least not explicitly, but also because of the way that transition is likely to happen. So the government is talking about privatization. I worry in Syria, because of the very high level of corruption, Syria has been ranking among the bottom five according to Corruption Perceptions Index over the past 5 to 6 years. I worry that this process, first, is premature. Second, is not going to happen in the way that it's meant to happen.
The cost of living in Syria, we should note, has historically been low. So I'm wondering if Syria's economy were to suddenly open up, could that make things less affordable? Like, are there unintended consequences here?
There are unintended consequences. And of course, I mean, when we're talking about, for example, raising salaries by 400% immediately, of course, this would actually result in inflation. But I think these concerns are blown out of proportion. I think, and the issue is, what are the trade-offs that we're talking about? Yes, there will be a bit of extra inflation, but you also have people who are starving without these additional increases. I think there will be increased inflation going forward, I think, if we assume money supply continues at this pace. But I think it's secondary to other issues.
So economic change in Syria realistically could take a long time, especially given all the work that needs to be accomplished to get things running again. Is your advice to your fellow Syrians to just keep expectations in check?
Absolutely. I think what we know from other similar contexts is that the transition will be slow, and that because of the complexity of the issues I had mentioned earlier, you know, the regulatory framework and sanctions, I think even if there is political will, these will take a long time to start to ease. So I think what lies ahead is definitely better than under the rule of Bashar al-Assad, but the transition will be slow. How much better it will be is contingent upon many factors, I think chief among which is the nature of political transition, how inclusive it will be, how much buy-in the ruling coalition will actually be able to get from Syrians and from the international community.
Karam Shah is a Syrian economist. He spoke with us from Damascus.
In Venezuela, the harsh reality of crime has found its way into a spiritual practice. Both people seeking protection from crime and criminals themselves are creating their own images of God, not just in Venezuela, but in other Latin American countries as well. The World's TBS Isaiah brings us this story from Mexico City and Caracas, Venezuela.
It's a curious cult practiced by thousands in an old cemetery south of Caracas. They call it La Corte Malandra, or the Thug Court. Here, people worship the spirits of criminals, which they believe can bestow divine favors on them. During rituals, people play drums and smoke cigars to communicate with these spirits. Tania Mendez comes to this cemetery daily. She lights a cigar and explains more.
Aquí viene todo el mundo, no nada más lo que están preso.
She says this cult is open to anyone. That includes people praying for loved ones who are in jail, parents seeking help for their children to stay away from drugs, and those who carry out illegal activities, who pray to these spirits before committing a crime or ask for help obtaining weapons or motorbikes.
Mira, lo que pasa es que esto es un acto de fe, como todo, en toda religión.
This is an act of faith, like in any other religion, says Fernanda, another participant. You come here with a lot of devotion and pray for anything you want. I ask her what she does for work.
Siguiente pregunta.
She pauses for a few seconds and requests that I ask a different question. People in this cemetery like hearing salsa. It was the favorite music of the main figure in this cult, El Chamo Ismael, or Kid Ismael. He's depicted smoking a cigar, wearing sunglasses, a baseball cap, and a pistol. Kid Ismael was a real person who was stabbed to death decades ago, says Alexander Nene, another devotee. He would steal food and distribute it among his neighbors in a poor area of Caracas, he says. He never killed anyone, but other figures in the thug cult have, he says. The altar here in the cemetery has many different figures, including Catholic saints.
Pistola, puñal, estupefaciente.
People leave guns, knives, cigars, and bottles of alcohol in these altars. Venezuela is not the only Latin American country where criminals resort to their own spiritual images to seek protection. Miles away in Mexico City, people gather in the streets to pray to Santa Muerte, or the Death Saint. Carlos Mendez is emptying a bottle of tequila on an icon of the Santa Muerte. It's a promise I'm paying to her, he says. She's the saint who helps everyone, no matter who they are or what they do. Andres Medina is an anthropologist from the Mexican Autonomous University.
Claro, es una elaboración que hacen grupos delictivos, podemos decir, que han hecho de esto una parte, un culto de protección.
He says this type of cults are created by criminal groups in need of a protection they don't get from Catholic saints. The Catholic Church forbids this type of cults, calling them satanic. The FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the Mexican government also discourage people from worshiping La Santa Muerte. But stigma hasn't prevented the expansion of these cults.
Yo creo en Dios, yo soy católico, pero soy religioso espiritista. Todos creemos en Dios.
Alex Nene, one of the believers of the Holy Thugs in Caracas, says he's also Catholic and that different spiritual beliefs should not be mutually exclusive. Both Santa Muerte and Holy Thug cults have a growing presence on social media and are crossing borders as many other devotees migrate. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, reporting from Caracas, Venezuela, and Mexico City.
Black South Africans served in World War I, but not as soldiers. Because of racist policies, they worked as laborers for the Allies, and many of them died. Since the war ended more than 100 years ago, the contributions and sacrifices of those soldiers have gone largely unrecognized. But a new monument in Cape Town aims to change that. The World's Sarah Birnbaum brings us a story.
Close to 2,000 members of the South African Native Labor Corps lost their lives on the Allied side during World War I. No one knows where they're buried, but now their names are inscribed on poles of African hardwood, part of the new memorial in the center of Cape Town. The poles stand in straight rows like soldiers. Each one has a name and a date of death, so each soldier is honored individually. But then when you take a step back and see the field of columns reaching to the sky, the scope of the loss slams into you. Britain's Princess Anne, who's president of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, unveiled the memorial on Wednesday at a moving ceremony attended by relatives of the dead.
Those we have come to pay tribute to have gone unacknowledged for too long. They gave their all in the most challenging of circumstances. Their courage and dedication were essential to the Allied efforts.
When war broke out in Europe in 1914, Black South Africans wanted to sign up, but the white minority South African government wouldn't let them enlist as soldiers. It didn't want them to carry arms, says Alan Wakefield. He's the curator of the Imperial War Museum in London.
The South African government were absolutely paranoid that these guys would come home, demand equality. They are the majority people there. They will train other people up. They know how to use modern weapons. And that, yeah, they'll start making political demands.
So instead, the black recruits were confined to labor battalions. The men in the Cape Town Labor Corps went to Europe, where they were kept segregated. They transported food and supplies, they unloaded ships, built bridges and roads, felled trees. Many of them died in bombings, shellings, or in accidents or of disease, like Besengile Dalilazo. He died, as far as researchers can tell, of malaria in 1917. One of the posts in the Cape Town Memorial bears his name. His great-nephew, Elliot Malunga Dalilazo, was at the dedication.
Although it pained us, we can't find the remains. On the other hand, it made us very proud. It made us very happy.
Happy that his family's sacrifice is finally being recognized. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Coming up, some of the international films that got Oscar nominations this morning. One standout, Emilia Perez. But not everyone's a fan. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Oscar nominations are in, and Emilia Perez, a musical from a French director about a trans cartel boss in Mexico, won a record number of nominations for a foreign language film. To dive into that and other international films getting Oscar nods, I spoke earlier with Lisa Nesselson. She's a longtime film critic based in Paris.
The Academy, I believe, has something like 10,000 members, and I'm told that now fully a third of them live and work outside the United States and probably in many languages besides English. So that's supposed to have influenced the depth of the decision making. Something that I do notice is out of the five films that made the cut for Best International Feature Film, which we all used to call foreign language, but they changed that a few years ago, is that they are directed by men, but very, very much about the lives of women.
Interesting. Let's dive in now to this record-setting film, Amelia Perez. It's hard to describe, as I learned a moment ago. Can you just give us the plot synopsis and talk about why you think it is earning such critical acclaim?
It's got 13 nominations. That is the same number of nominations as Oppenheimer had last year. The difference being, for me, that Oppenheimer is an enduring, impressive accomplishment, and Amelia Perez is a mostly silly telenovela, melodramatic layer cake of various components. So it's directed by a 72-year-old cisgender white guy, a Frenchman named Jacques Audiard, and it's in the Spanish language. It has, I think, over a dozen songs and dancing, and it is the story of an absolutely vicious Mexican drug lord cartel boss, but he confides in a woman lawyer that what he's really always felt himself to be is a woman, and he wants to transition into being that woman. So he successfully does that, becomes a woman, renames himself Amelia Perez, and complications ensue.
Interesting. Which of the other nominations in the Best International Features category stand out to you?
All of them do. I'm Still Here from Brazil by Walter Salles is an absolutely devastatingly good fact-based film. It starts in 1970 in Brazil under the dictatorship, and it's the story of a tight-knit family with five children and the basic housewife mom who has to navigate a world of doubt and tension when her husband is arrested out of the blue one day and never heard from again. The Girl with the Needle from Denmark is a relatively young male director, and this is an absolutely gorgeous but sinister, intense movie about how few choices poor women had at the turn of the prior century in Denmark if you had an unwanted pregnancy. The Seed of the Sacred Fig by Iranian Mohammad Ruslov. Now, he's had a career in Iran, but the authorities had basically had it with him, and this was made under clandestine, very dangerous circumstances. And then again, a man telling a very good story about how women are being oppressed by men. Mm-hmm. And then Flo, which is by a Latvian director, made with French money, and this is a thrilling animated film that is also nominated for Best Animated Film. Boy, is it good. It doesn't have a single word of dialogue because it's a sort of post-apocalyptic, presumably Earth, where there are no humans, just animals. You know, see it on the biggest screen you can. It's a joy.
Is there a film you saw this year that you thought should have been nominated in the international category?
Yes. Agnieszka Holland, who now at 80-something is one of our most talented international directors, and she made a stupendous film called Green Border about how refugees are political footballs under, you know, absolutely harrowing conditions in Eastern Europe. It is thrilling to watch.
Lisa Nesselson is a film critic based in Paris. She mentioned the Iranian film, The Seed of the Sacred Fig. We will have the daring story of how that film was made Monday on The World.
Turkey is burying the victims of a fire that claimed 78 lives on Tuesday. The blaze ripped through the hotel of a ski resort in the Bolu Mountains east of Istanbul. The dead include a well-known journalist, a chef working for the resort, and 14 members of the same family. The World's Duri Buscarin reports from Istanbul that many people are saying this was just the latest preventable tragedy in Turkey.
In the courtyard of a mosque in Istanbul, four coffins draped in green velvet and Turkish flags lay in a line as friends, neighbors, and relatives stopped to pay their respects. The Güngör family was staying on the sixth floor of the Grand Kartal Hotel. Seventh grader Pelin, her little brother Kerem, their mother Burcu, a young chemical company executive, their father, Givenchy. Often at funerals in Turkey, people pin small photos of the deceased to their clothing. This time, mourners were given a photo of the entire family to wear, because this family died together. In news interviews, survivors repeatedly described how difficult it was to escape without basic fire security measures. There were no fire alarms that sounded, no fire extinguishers in the rooms, a survivor told a local TV journalist. There were no rescuers, another survivor said. It took about an hour for emergency responders to arrive. This man escaped by climbing down bedsheets that had been knotted together. When the mayor of Bolu, where the fire took place, visited survivors, a tearful mother confronted him. They couldn't tell us how to escape, she said. My child might be dead. He's 16 years old, and I don't know. A recent fire inspection had noted some safety concerns at the Grand Kartal Hotel, but it appears a hotel manager tried to get around them. The Turkish government arrested 11 people, including the hotel owner, and has pledged an investigation. Meanwhile, pent-up anger is spilling out over social media. We are all tired of offering condolences, says Aras, who has a comedy channel on Instagram called Turkish Dictionary. He asked not to use his full name because he's sometimes critical of the government. In this short video, he connects the hotel fire with a long list of recent tragedies in Turkey. A derailed train in 2018, a factory explosion, the buildings that collapsed in the earthquakes 2 years ago, which killed more than 55,000 people. Ne sorumlu bulunuyor, ne ceza veriliyor, ne de neyin düzeltileceği söyleniyor. No responsibility is found, no punishment is given, he says. We pay with our lives to make a few people richer. In a press conference on Tuesday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan promised that anyone who was responsible, acted negligently, or had fault in the disaster would be brought to justice. But Aras's video has been viewed more than 15 million times. When I called him, Aras said, people in Turkey have had enough.
These things keep happening, and we don't figure out who is the person responsible for this.
Aras says a lack of accountability, government inaction, and general corruption are to blame for this string of tragedies. Developers that pass inspections by paying bribes.
You don't cut corners on safety.
And people in Turkey deserve to feel safe, he says. For The World, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
You're listening to The World. How we travel makes a huge difference in what we soak up from the experience.
Walking kind of democratizes you more than driving a car or flying a plane. It puts you at boot level with everybody else.
And this man is walking across the planet. We check in with National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek, plus more global news still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. When you take a train or bus or the subway in the United States, it's probably part of a government-run system. But not in Japan. These sprawling transit systems there are run by private companies, and they're widely considered some of the best in the world. The World's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel went to Tokyo to see if the model could work elsewhere.
When I board my train at rush hour in Tokyo, it is packed. Like, really, really packed. Tokyo Metro employees wearing ties and white gloves stand outside of the doors, firmly plant their feet to the ground, and push riders into the car, squeezing as many people as possible in before the doors close. The next train comes in just a couple minutes. More crowds arrive. The professional people pushers pack them in, and the process repeats. The scene is a far cry from what you might see on public transit in the U.S., where ridership is down and systems are operating under massive deficits. 6.5 million people take Tokyo Metro every day, more than double the entire New York City subway. And it's just one of more than a dozen major rail operators in the region.
Tokyo Metro 広報部課長補佐のコント、コンタクマと申します。
Kon Takuma is a deputy manager at Tokyo Metro. He tells me for a long time, the Metro was government-owned, a holdout in a mostly privatized system. But late last year, the government sold off its majority ownership in the country's most successful IPO in years. He says privatization will help Tokyo Metro grow even larger and more efficient. To understand if that's possible, you just have to turn to the country's other rail operators.
Privatization has been a good thing.
Professor Tamahiko Taniguchi was an advisor to Shinzo Abe when he was Prime Minister of Japan and has extensive experience both taking trains and helping run them, with a 5-year stint working with one of the country's biggest train companies, JR Central. As we stand in the middle of a busy station south of Tokyo, he tells me transportation drastically improved in the 80s when most railways privatized amid a cascade of financial and operational problems under government ownership.
I belong to a generation that remembers vividly how unfriendly JR companies were. If you went to the ticketing counter and asked for a ticket for your journey from Tokyo to Osaka, they just threw, literally, they just threw their tickets away from the ticketing counter to you.
When the trains went private, customer service improved, train lines expanded, and profits for the train companies did too. They expanded beyond transit, developing real estate around their stations, running grocery and department stores, restaurants, hotels, even hospitals. Today, some 40 million people ride trains daily in Tokyo alone. Railways around the country are extensive, frequent, and punctual. In the unlikely event that a train is late, riders are given special notes to explain their delay to work. The success story raises the question of whether other systems around the world should consider privatization as well.
It's incredibly complicated.
Terrace Gresko is a Canadian transit advocate and author of the book Strap Hanger, which compares different transportation systems around the world. He cautions that the lesson from Japanese transit shouldn't be all systems should go private, and says that globally, the country is an anomaly.
When you look around the world, the countries that are doing this best are the ones that have, you know, nationalized, publicly owned rail systems. I'm thinking like Switzerland, the Netherlands. And the exceptions to that rule, like the UK, privatization has been a disaster.
Later this year, the newly privatized Tokyo Metro will be put to the test internationally when the company helps take over operation of the Elizabeth Line, a new rail service in London that in the past has struggled with reliability. Whether or not the Brits can expect professional people pushers, that is an open question. For The World, Jeremy Siegel, Tokyo.
Parts of the UK are bracing for hurricane-force winds tomorrow. Storm Eowyn was responsible for the bitter cold in the U.S. this week, and now it's cruising toward northern England, Scotland, and northern Ireland. Winds could hit 100 miles an hour, and that can cause dangerous flying debris.
Earlier today, the storm had a different, surprising effect on one particular object in the air, a commercial flight from Las Vegas to London. The plane reached 814 miles per hour with that tailwind. That's nearly 300 miles per hour faster than the average speed of commercial planes. Pilots often use jet streams to cut down on flight times and save fuel. In this case, the push from the incoming storm was so powerful, the flight landed an hour ahead of schedule. On the downside, airlines say the dangerous weather could force delays and cancellations as the storm makes landfall in the UK.
As part of a series of executive orders relating to immigration, President Trump has paused a refugee admissions program. It's a move that's already affecting thousands of people across the globe, and it will affect even more. The Department of Homeland Security has 90 days to assess whether to make the suspension permanent after it investigates whether the program serves the U.S. national interest. In the meantime, there's a lot on the line for refugees and the people who provide services for them. Krish Omara Vignaraja runs Global Refuge. It's one of 10 refugee resettlement agencies in the U.S. I asked her who was impacted by the program's suspension.
So these are refugees coming from all over the world,
These are persecuted families fleeing for their lives. They've gone through years of intensive vetting, and they're going to now languish in limbo. You know, it's a process where they've spent a year or two, they've gone through the UN or the US embassy, they've applied, they've gone through extreme vetting, health clearances, they had their flights booked, they were ready to come. But we found that even those who had flights before the effective date of the administration suspension, which was supposed to be January 27th, in the last 24 hours and for all of this week, flights have been canceled.
I understand that it's roughly 10,000 refugees who had been approved to come to the United States, already had their flights or other travel booked for the next few weeks. What happens to them? You say limbo, but what are their options now?
There aren't many. Because the program has been suspended indefinitely, it's not as though we're able to signal that we can rebook them in coming days. Our hope is that within this 90-day period that the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of State will realize that this is obviously a program that has always aligned in terms of working with local communities, figuring out affordable housing, whether there's employment. You know, there's a complex algorithm that goes into where they ultimately move. We as a resettlement agency are there to support them. So it's not as though these communities are overwhelmed. But we saw this during the first Trump administration. And after the suspension was lifted, unfortunately, the refugee resettlement system was decimated. But we hope that doesn't happen this time.
So last time around, President Trump paused the program and then reinstated it. But there were many fewer refugees allowed into the country than in the Obama years or in the Biden years. Is that accurate?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Do you have any sense of if something like that is likely to happen again?
So refugee resettlement is really the gold standard in terms of a humanitarian program that requires people to wait in a third country or a refugee camp. They go through every hurdle and hoop that we impose. And when they arrive, they've already been extremely vetted. And so our hope is that this program will be protected. But certainly during the first Trump administration, we saw the number of refugees go from, during President Obama's end of the term, 85,000 to just 11,000.
Historically, looking back a bit farther, the resettlement program has had broad bipartisan support. When did that start to change?
So President Reagan resettled 600,000 refugees during his time in office. It has always had bipartisan support because it is this well-structured, orderly process. But unfortunately, I think there has been a conflation between the refugee resettlement program and the southern border, and they really are quite different programs. Unfortunately, even in the executive order, they allude to how certain communities like Denver and New York City have been overwhelmed. But again, we are talking about a different population. Refugees work with the State Department. As I said, when they enter the U.S., essentially their legal process has ended because they have been reviewed and admitted. And so I think perhaps it is that confusion that has led to some of the rhetoric we have had that has been very adversarial to refugee resettlement.
So the incoming Trump administration in the executive order ordering this refugee program suspension said that the vetting process for the program is weak and that these refugees take jobs from American workers in some communities. What is your sense between the resources in these U.S. communities and refugees settling there when it comes to things like jobs?
The program really represents the gold standard of legal immigration pathways in terms of security screening, community coordination, mutual economic benefit. Refugees undergo rigorous vetting, including multiple background checks by national security agencies before ever setting foot on American soil. And their integration is coordinated through close collaboration between federal agencies, local stakeholders, nonprofit organizations, which positions them to quickly become vital contributors to their new communities. And so that's why it's been so frustrating to see this program suspended, because the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program was designed and fine-tuned over four decades precisely to address the supposed concerns cited in the executive order.
Krish Omara Vignaraja heads Global Refuge, one of the 10 refugee resettlement agencies in the U.S. She's been speaking with us about the Trump administration's decision to pause the refugee admissions program.
President Trump is a big fan of the Hungarian prime minister.
Viktor Orban, one of the most respected men, they call him a strong man. He's a tough person.
smart.
Viktor Orban has been in power now for 14 years. In that time, he and his allies have seized control of a lot of the media in Hungary. Today, only around 20% of news outlets there are considered independent. And some media watchers say that should serve as a warning to the U.S. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, has more.
Wages are going up in Hungary. That's one of today's top stories on M1, the country's public media channel. Viktor Orban is calling it a new era for the Hungarian economy. But not everyone buys that.
Yeah, it sounds like a fact. However, it's not true.
Gábor Poyák is head of the watchdog group Mertek Media Monitor. He says M1 is a propaganda arm for Orban's government. 14 years ago, though, the media environment in Hungary looked very different.
There was a pretty diverse, pluralistic media landscape.
András Pethő is co-founder of Direct 36, an investigative news outlet in Budapest. Orban and his party had always made it very clear, Pethő says, how they felt about the media.
They didn't trust journalists overall. You know, they thought that the media is biased, the media is, news media is too liberal or too left-wing.
But no one expected the changes to happen so fast after Orban was elected. First, they came for the public broadcaster,
which is something like the BBC. It's supposed to be impartial, independent, but under Orban's rule, it was turned into a mouthpiece for the government.
Orban set up a new media regulatory authority and stuffed it, Gábor Poyák says, with members of his own Fidesz party.
Only the Fidesz-dominated guys can take part in decisions. There is no transparency.
Many private outlets were already struggling after the global financial crisis of 2008. They depended on advertising, and most of that, Poyák says, came from the state. So either outlets towed the party line or they lost funding. And once they were on their knees, wealthy allies of Orban's would often swoop in and buy them up. In 2014, journalists at Origo, a hugely popular independent news site, started to feel the pressure. András Pethő was working there at the time.
We faced requests, you know, to not to pursue certain stories or to remove articles from the website. You know, we pushed back just after a few months. My colleague, the editor-in-chief, was forced out of his job and I resigned.
Today, Pethő says, Origo is considered yet another mouthpiece of the Orban government. Hundreds of print and digital outlets, television channels and radio stations are all now state-controlled or under the ownership of wealthy allies of Viktor Orban's. Outgoing US ambassador to Hungary, David Pressman, said recently this has created an atmosphere of fear.
Because if you speak up, you will likely become a target. You can be smothered with lies, splashed on the front pages, subjected to online smear campaigns.
András Pethő and his reporters at Direct 36 have found themselves regular targets of smear campaigns by pro-government media outlets. But now Pethő finds himself in the unusual position of giving advice to journalists in the US.
I'm telling my American colleagues and friends that, you know, yes, you should brace yourself for the worst. So, yes, you have, you know, armed yourself with good lawyers, you know, learn digital security and learn ways that you can protect your sources and your employees, your colleagues.
Orban could easily change media laws because his party has a majority in parliament. Jeremy Shapiro with the European Council on Foreign Relations says US outlets may be more vulnerable than they realize.
I think unbeknownst to a lot of Americans, a lot of what limited the president in previous administrations was simply their own adherence to various norms of activity. And actually the legal system in the United States is incredibly favorable and ever more so to accumulations of presidential power.
Shapiro says the new US administration could take a page out of Orban's playbook by accusing media groups of infringements like tax violations or bombarding them with lawsuits. And it doesn't even matter, he says, if those cases fail.
Once you tie up these media organizations in lawsuits, you both reduce their profitability, which is already very difficult for media organizations, make them vulnerable to take over, and you deter others from going down that route because they don't want to end up in court.
U.S. media outlets need to strengthen their business model and lawyer up, he says. But András Pethő in Budapest says there is one message he wants to pass on to journalists who are feeling the pressure right now.
You know, we have one source of power or influence, and that's the public, that's our audience. You know, if we serve them well and if we have a big and diverse audience, you know, that's the best protection that you can have against any kind of crackdown and against any kind of autocrat.
It's because of the public that Direct 36, his investigative outlet, has survived, he says. It hasn't been easy, but 10 years on, he says, we're still here. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Still ahead for you, a very long walk all over the globe.
Put yourself in my boots. 12 years of walking, tens of thousands of kilometers. It becomes your life.
We catch up with National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek next.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek began a journey in Ethiopia in January of 2013. His Out of Eden walk has taken him across 21 countries, tracing humanity's journey out of Africa and across the world. He's traveled more than 14,000 miles, all of it on foot. We usually speak with Paul about a particular stretch of his adventure, but at this point, Paul has been walking for 12 years, and we thought that in and of itself warranted a conversation. So today we've invited him on the show to talk about the walk. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Marco, it's great to be with you again.
And where are you now as we speak?
I'm in the western part of Honshu, the main island of Japan. I've been walking through Japan for a few months now after having crossed South Korea over the summer.
And we spoke to you along that path. You began your walk, though, in the Rift Valley of Ethiopia 12 years ago. What do you remember about that first day?
It was chaotic. I'd been preparing the logistics for this walk for well over a year from the U.S., and you'd think everything would have been kind of nailed down and on schedule, but the camels that I thought I'd rented were nowhere to be found. Bags that I thought had been transferred did not arrive, so we ended up kind of starting a bit late. That's okay, though. This is a very long journey. Started late with different camels and a roller bag, the kind you roll through airports, strapped to the back of them because I couldn't find my canvas bags.
And you are still walking.
That's right.
Where's the journey going to end?
So this project is premised on the idea of following the first anatomically modern Homo sapiens who walked out of Africa back in the Middle Stone Age. And so I'm walking to where scientists are telling me is kind of the last corner, the last nook and cranny of the continents that they reached. And that was the tip of South America, a place called Tierra del Fuego, way down in where Argentina and Chile are.
What has surprised you the most about what it's like to walk the earth, like to see it on foot and to feel this distance in your body?
It's been a slow accumulation of realizations. At the beginning, you know, there was a lot of, you know, anxiety about whether I was going to make it even a fraction of the way. But after all this time, it becomes your life.
Yeah.
It actually sort of is now my daily existence. And I think that one lesson I take away is once you adapt to it, it becomes easy. I guess the biggest surprise is how easy it has been.
And that first day, like you took those first steps and you're like, wow, I've got to do this all the way around the world. Did it seem daunting?
Yeah, based on that one day, there were questions about whether I'd make it to the next Tuesday. You know, there's kit falling off the camels and we were having to go back and pick it up.
You've traveled with a lot of locals in the 21 countries so far along your route. What have those walking partners meant to you?
Very early on, I knew that I was going to be walking with people. This is a people project. I can tell you what my impressions are walking across Ethiopia or China or South Korea, but they would soon become repetitive. Mm. So I walk with local people who add their own voices, their own insights, and therefore it's constantly being refreshed. The journey is constantly being made new.
And when you are figuring out which way to go, how much are you relying on guides to show you the way, or are you using GPS, or maybe you feel the rhythm of footsteps is best aligned with old paper maps?
You know, I started with paper maps. Sometimes I use online navigational apps, but my walking partners, again, are my human mapping experts. They know the terrain. They sort of know where the best shops might be, where to kind of find a place for shelter that doesn't always appear on things like Google Maps.
Yeah. I mean, you knew from the start you'd walk to the southernmost tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego, as you said. How much have you had to improvise?
How about
all the time. So there is no stability in this project. You know, people sometimes say, what do you take away so far? You're more than a decade in. Any kind of epiphany, kind of, one of the big ones is over-planning. So you have to plan. You have to kind of sort of know where deserts are. I have to know where the next water supply. But this project has rid me of the impulse, whatever I had of it, of over-planning. And I think, you know, over-planning comes with having resources, you know, coming from a wealthy society, my physical identity, kind of being an older white guy, all these privileges that come with the package that my body is. But walking kind of democratizes you, you know, up to a point, more than driving a car or flying a plane. It puts you at boot level with everybody else who's on foot out in this landscape. And so I have learned to become comfortable with uncertainty.
Yeah, so that's one epiphany. And let me get you to go deeper in that, because your journey began near the Red Sea. It took you 12 years to walk to the edge of the Pacific Ocean. You're not done yet. But it took the people who did this back in the day, millennia ago, many lifetimes, many generations, to cover the same distance. So what is taking this on in one lifetime, not even one lifetime, in 12 years, taught you?
Huge difference. And I have to remind my readers that I am not in any way replicating the original human discovery of the planet.
Right.
That's the kind of conceptual part of it. But our ancestors took more than 50,000 years after kind of rambling out of Africa with no destination in mind, right? This is before destinations had been invented to reach the tip of South America. I might do it in 15 or 16 years. I'm moving pretty steadily in one direction. They were going in circles. They were going backwards. They were going sideways because they're looking for resources. They're hunters and gatherers. The big difference is that they were traveling in communities, right? Hunter-gatherer bands ranged in size from like a dozen to maybe up to maximum 40. That's about as many human beings as you can feed off the landscape that you're moving through. So the people who discovered the planet were not dudes. They were not guys. They weren't like me. They were communities that included old women, they included children, they included people of every age. Mm. And so one of the things I've taken away through my small kind of experience with walking partners is it does take a community to have a life with meaning, including if you're always plodding across a continent. So my community are my walking partners.
Again, Paul, you're not at your destination yet, but do you think much about life after the walk, how this unique experience will change you?
Well, you know, I started as a journalist, and I'm still a journalist. I'm 12 years older. My hair has turned almost white in the course of these years. Mm-hmm. And sure, I'm thinking about sort of, you know, I hope I'm going to make it to the tip of Tierra del Fuego. If I do, that's great. If I don't, that's the way it's going to be, too. Just take it day by day. Mm. And that also is, people do ask me, so when you are going to hang up your boots at Beagle Channel at the tip of South America, where Darwin kind of did his original discoveries, that is my finish line. I really don't know. I'm not going to turn around and walk back. Probably not. But who knows? I will leave that option open. Probably continue writing, right, in some capacity. But and also using my body, keep moving around. But I don't really have a solid plan yet. My world is consumed. My thoughts are consumed by what I can see in my immediate horizon, right, what my eyes can see. That's where my concerns are in my life right now.
You can see photos and stories Paul has posted on his journey from Africa across the Middle East all the way to East Asia. They're at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org and at our website, theworld.org. Paul, as always, thank you very much.
Marco, it's always a pleasure. One day, let's get you out on the trail.
I would love that.
Well, there's a good 10,000 kilometers left, so you have a lot to pick from.
Okay. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. As you know, you can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Judy Piggott, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.